Hello and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm Cory Doctorow, and if you're tuning in now, you've probably just heard me conclude the reading of my novella, There's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow, Now is the Best Time of Your Life. I've been doing this now for, I guess, a couple of years, this podcast, coming up in a couple of years, and in the process of doing so, I seem to have read pretty much all the short fiction I've written, with the exception of a few collaborations and some miscellanea. So I decided that I would take a break from reading my own stuff. I did this once before. I read you Peter Gutman's Vista Suicide Note paper, which everyone seemed to enjoy quite a lot. So this time I thought I'm going to read you a longer work, a work that really meant a lot to me, means a lot to me, by my friend Bruce Sterling. I'm going to read Bruce Sterling's 1992 classic nonfiction account of the founding of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the early days of the War for Internet Liberty, a book called The Hacker Crackdown. The Hacker Crackdown was incredibly influential in me, in my life. I read it in 1991 in a set of galleys that were dropped off at the science fiction bookstore I was working at by the rep for Bruce's publisher, and I brought it with me to Clarion, to the science fiction writing workshop that I attended that summer, and just talked it up to everyone. It had meant so much to me. And then, you know, 2 years later, I had dropped out of university and I was working in the web, and I found that Bruce had released the full text of the book as a free download. And that was pretty amazing because I had never heard of an author releasing a book as a free internet download before. I don't think anyone had. It was a genuinely visionary and weird thing for Bruce to have done, and quite an alarming circumstance. So 1994, he released this ebook. And you know, it was the first book I ever read off a screen, and I ended up writing a couple of essays about it, and the ability to copy and paste text out of it was really something. So the book is about 100,000 words long, and my accounting says that that's going to take me about 20 weeks to read, maybe a little longer. I'm going to be out of town for a little while. I'm going this summer to Australia, and then Japan, and then China. And there might be several weeks in there when I can't do any reading. So this might take me all the way to December, which would be quite amazing, quite a big chunk of time in any event. I hope that this book means as much to you as it does to me. One of the reasons I'm reading it is because I'm hoping to share it with a new generation of people who might not have read it the first time around all those years ago. It's now been 15 years since the initial release. And like I said, I talked to Bruce about this last week in Serbia, and asked him if he minded if I did this, and he said, no, with my blessing, although he suggested that I might have a hard time reading the emergency 911 document, which you'll hear about a lot in this. It's one of the MacGuffins of the story of the early days of internet liberty. Well, with no further ado, I'm going to start reading to you, beginning with the preface. In the traditional world of print, the Hacker Crackdown is ISBN 0553-08058X and is formally cataloged by the Library of Congress as 1. Computer Crimes, United States, 2. Telephone, United States, Corrupt Practices, 3. Programming, Electronic Computers, United States, Corrupt Practices. Corrupt Practices. I always get a kick out of that description. Librarians are very ingenious people. The paperback is ISBN 0-553-56370-X. If you go and buy a print version of the Hacker Crackdown, an action I encourage heartily, you may notice that in the front of the book, beneath the copyright notice, copyright 1992 by Bruce Sterling, it has this little block of printed legal boilerplate from the publisher. It says, and I quote, "No part of this book may be reproduced or transmitted in any form by any means, electronic or mechanical, including photocopying, recording, or by any information storage and retrieval system, without permission in writing from the publisher. For information, address Bantam Books." This is a pretty good disclaimer, as such disclaimers go. I collect intellectual property disclaimers. I've seen dozens of them, and this one is at least pretty straightforward. In this particular and narrow case, however, it isn't quite accurate. Bantam Books puts that disclaimer on every book they publish, but Bantam Books does not, in fact, own the electronic rights to this book. I do, because of certain extensive contract maneuverings my agent and I went through before this book was written. I want to give those electronic publishing rights away through certain not-for-profit channels, and I've convinced Bantam that this is a good idea. Since Bantam has seen fit to peaceably agree to this scheme of mine, Bantam Books is not going to fuss about this. Provided you don't try to sell the book, they are not going to bother you for what you do with the electronic copy of this book. If you want to check this out personally, you can ask them. They're at 1540 Broadway, New York, New York, 10036. However, if you are so foolish as to print a copy of this book and start retailing it for money in violation of my copyright and the commercial interests of Bantam Books, then Bantam, a part of the giant Bertelsmann multinational publishing combine, would rouse some of their heavy-duty attorneys out of hibernation and crush you like a bug. This is only to be expected. I didn't write this book so that you could make money out of it. If anybody is going to make money out of this book, it's going to be me and my publisher. My publisher deserves to make money out of this book. Not only did the folks at Bantam Books commission me to write this book, and pay me a hefty sum to do so, but they bravely printed, in text, an electronic document, the reproduction of which was once alleged to be a federal felony. Bantam Books and their numerous attorneys were very brave and forthright about this book. Furthermore, my former editor at Bantam Books, Betsy Mitchell, genuinely cared about this project and worked hard on it and had a lot of wise things to say about the manuscript. Betsy deserves genuine credit for this book, credit that editors too rarely get. The critics were very kind to the hacker crackdown, and commercially the book has done well. On the other hand, I didn't write this book in order to squeeze every last nickel and dime out of the midst of impoverished 16-year-old cyberpunk high school students. Teenagers don't have any money. No, not even enough for the $6 hacker crackdown paperback with its attractive bright red cover and useful index. That's a major reason why teenagers sometimes succumb to the temptation to do things they shouldn't, such as swiping my books out of libraries. Kids, this one is all yours, all right? Go give the print version back. And Bruce here inserts a smiley. Well-meaning, public-spirited civil libertarians don't have much money either, and it seems almost criminal to snatch cash out of the hands of America's direly underpaid electronic law enforcement community. If you're a computer cop, a hacker, or an electronic civil liberties activist, you are the target audience for this book. I wrote this book because I wanted to help you and help other people understand you and your unique, problems. I wrote this book to aid your activities and to contribute to the public discussion of important political issues. In giving the text away in this fashion, I am directly contributing to the book's ultimate aim, to help civilize cyberspace. Information wants to be free, and the information inside this book longs for freedom with a peculiar intensity. I genuinely believe that the natural habitat of this book is inside an electronic network. It may not be the easiest direct method to generate revenue for the book's author, but that doesn't matter. This is where the book belongs by its nature. I have written other books, plenty of other books, and I'll write more, and I am writing more, but this one is special. I am making the Hacker Crackdown available electronically as widely as I can conveniently manage, and if you like the book and think it is useful, then I urge you to do the same with it. You can copy this electronic book. Copy the heck out of it. Be my guest, and give those copies to anybody who wants them. The nascent world of cyberspace is full of sysadmins, teachers, trainers, cybrarians, net gurus, and various species of cybernetic activists. If you're one of those people, I know about you, and I know the hassle you go to try and help the people learn about the electronic frontier. I hope that possessing this book in an electronic form will lessen your troubles. Granted, this treatment of our electronic social spectrum is not the ultimate in academic rigor, and politically, it has something to offend and trouble almost everyone. But hey, I'm told it's readable, and at least the price is right. You can upload the book onto bulletin board systems, or internet nodes, or electronic discussion groups. Go right ahead and do that. I'm giving you express permission right now. Enjoy yourself. You can put the book on discs and give the book discs away, as long as you don't take any money for it. But this book is not public domain. You can't copyright it in your own name. I own the copyright. Attempts to pirate this book and make money from selling it may involve you in a serious litigative snarl. Believe me, for the pittance you might wring out of such an action, it's not really worth it. This book doesn't belong to you. In an odd but very genuine way, I feel it doesn't belong to me either. It's a book about the people of cyberspace, and distributing it in this way is the best way I know to actually make this information available, freely and easily, to all the people of cyberspace, including people far outside the borders of the United States who otherwise may never have a chance to see any edition of this book, and who may perhaps learn something useful from this strange story of distant, obscure, but portentous event in the so-called American cyberspace. This electronic book is now literary freeware. It now belongs to the emergent realm of alternative information economics. You have no right to make this electronic book part of the conventional flow of commerce. Let it be part of the flow of knowledge. There is a difference. I've divided the book into four sections so that it is less ungainly for upload and download. If there is a section of particular relevance to you and your colleagues, feel free to reproduce that one and skip the rest. Just make more when you need them and give them to whomever might want them. Now, have fun. Chronology of the Hacker Crackdown. 1865, U.S. Secret Service founded. 1876, Alexander Graham Bell invents telephone. 1878, first teenage males flung off phone system by enraged authorities. 1939, Futurian science fiction group raided by Secret Service. 1971, Yippie phone freaks start Yipple/Tap magazine. 1972, Ramparts magazine seized in Blue Box ripoff scandal. 1978, Ward Christensen and Randy Seuss create the first personal computer bulletin board system. 1982, William Gibson coins term cyberspace, 414 gang raided. 1983, AT&T dismantled in divestiture. 1984, Congress passes Comprehensive Crime Control Act, giving the U.S. Secret Service jurisdiction over credit card fraud and computer fraud. Legion of Doom founded. 2600, The Hacker Quarterly founded. Whole Earth Software Catalog published. 1985, first police sting bulletin board systems well established. Whole Earth Electronic Link Computer Conference, well, goes online. 1986, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act passed. Electronic Communications Privacy Act passed. 1987, Chicago prosecutors form Computer Fraud and Abuse Task Force. 1988, July, Secret Service covertly videotapes SummerCon hacker convention. September, Prophet cracks Bell South AIM-SX computer network and downloads E911 document to his own computer and to JALnet. September, AT&T corporate information security informed of Prophet's action. October, Bellcore security informed of Prophet's action. 1989, January, Prophet uploads E911 document to Night Lightning. February 25, Night Lightning publishes E911 document in FRAC, electronic newsletter. May, Chicago Task Force raids and arrests Kyrie. June, new Prometheus League distributes Apple Computer proprietary software. June 13, Florida probation office crossed with phone sex line and switching station stunt. July, Fry Guy raided by U.S. Secret Service and Chicago Computer Fraud and Abuse Task Force. Secret Service raids Prophet, Leftist, and Irville in Georgia. 1990, January 15, Martin Luther King Day crash strikes AT&T long-distance network nationwide. January 18 to 19, Chicago Task Force raids Night Lightning in St. Louis. January 24, U.S. Secret Service and New York State Police raid Fiber Optic, Acid Freak, and Scorpion in New York City. February 1, U.S. Secret Service raids Terminus in Maryland. February 3, Chicago Task Force raids Richard Andrews' home. February 6, Chicago Task Force raids Richard Andrews' business. February 6, U.S. Secret Service arrests Terminus, Prophet, Leftist, and Irville. February 9, Chicago Task Force arrests Night Lightning. February 20, AT&T Security shuts down the public access AT&T-CTC computer in Dallas. February 21, Chicago Task Force raids Robert Eisenberg in Austin. March 1st, Chicago Task Force raids Steve Jackson Games Incorporated, Mentor, and Eric Bloodaxe in Austin. May 7th, 8th, and 9th, USSS and an Arizona Organized Crime and Racketeering Bureau conduct Operation Sun Devil raids in Cincinnati, Detroit, Los Angeles, Miami, Newark, Phoenix, Pittsburgh, Richmond, Tucson, San Diego, San Jose, and San Francisco. May, FBI interviews John Perry Barlow regarding New Prometheus case. June, Mitch Kapoor and Barlow found the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Barlow publishes Crime and Puzzlement Manifesto. June 24th to 27th, The Trial of Night Lightning. 1991, February, CPSR Roundtable in Washington, D.C. March 25th through 28th, Computer Freedom and Privacy Conference in San Francisco. May 1st, Electronic Frontier Foundation Steve Jackson and others file suit against members of Chicago Task Force. July 1-2, switching station phone software crash affects Washington, Los Angeles, Pittsburgh, San Francisco. September 17th, AT&T phone crash affects New York City and three airports. Introduction. This is a book about cops and wild teenage whiz kids, and lawyers, and hairy-eyed anarchists, and industrial technicians, and hippies, and high-tech millionaires, and game hobbyists, and computer security experts, and Secret Service agents, and grifters, and thieves. This is a book about the electronic frontier of the 1990s. It concerns activities that take place inside computers and over telephone lines. A science fiction writer coined the useful term cyberspace in 1982, but the territory in question, the electronic frontier, is about 130 years old. Cyberspace is the place where a telephone conversation appears to occur. Not inside your actual phone, the plastic device on your desk. Not inside the other person's phone in some other city. The place between the phones. The indefinite place, out there, where the two of you, two human beings, actually meet and communicate. Although it is not exactly real, cyberspace is a genuine place. Things happen there that have very genuine consequences. This place is not real, but it is serious, it is earnest. Tens of thousands of people have dedicated their lives to it, to the public service of public communication by wire and electronics. People have worked on this frontier for generations now. Some people became rich and famous for their efforts there. Some just played in it as hobbyists. Others soberly pondered it and wrote about it and regulated it and negotiated over it in international forums and sued one another about it in gigantic epic court battles that lasted for years. And almost since the beginning, some people have committed crimes in this place. But in the past 20 years, this electrical space, which was once thin and dark and one-dimensional, little more than a narrow speaking tube stretching from phone to phone, has flung itself open like a gigantic jack-in-the-box. Light has flooded in upon it, the eerie light of the glowing computer screen. This dark electronic netherworld has become a vast, flowering electronic landscape. Since the 1960s, the world of the telephone has crossbred itself with computers and television, and though there is no substance to cyberspace, nothing you can handle, it has a strange kind of physicality now. It makes good sense today to talk of cyberspace as a place all its own. Because people live in it now. Not just a few people, not just a few technicians and eccentrics, but thousands of people. Quite normal people, and not just for a little while either, but for hours straight over weeks and months and years. Cyberspace today is a net, a matrix, international in scope and growing swiftly and steadily. It's growing in size and wealth and political importance. People are making entire careers in modern cyberspace. Scientists and technicians, of course, they've been there for 20 years now, but increasingly cyberspace is filling with journalists and doctors and lawyers and artists and clerks. Civil servants make their careers there now, online in vast government data banks, and so do spies, industrial political, and just plain snoops. And so do police, at least a few of them, and there are children living there now. People have met and married there. There are entire living communities in cyberspace today, chattering, gossiping, planning, conferring and scheming, leaving one another voicemail and electronic mail, giving one another big, weightless chunks of valuable data, both legitimate and illegitimate. They busily pass one another computer software and the occasional festering computer virus. We do not really understand how to live in cyberspace yet. We are feeling our way into it, blundering about. This is not surprising. Our lives in the physical world, the real world, are also far from perfect, despite a lot more practice. Human lives, real lives, are imperfect by their nature, and there are human beings in cyberspace. The way we live in cyberspace is a funhouse mirror of the way we live in the real world. We take both our advantages and our troubles with us. This is a book about cyberspace. Specifically, this book is about certain strange events in the year 1990, an unprecedented and startling year for the growing world of computerized communications. In 1990, there was a nationwide crackdown on illicit computer hackers, with arrests, criminal charges, one dramatic show trial, several guilty pleas, and huge confiscations of data and equipment all over the USA. The hacker crackdown of 1990 was larger, better organized, more deliberate, and more resolute than any previous effort in the brave new world of computer crime. The U.S. Secret Service, private telephone security, and state and local law enforcement groups across the country all joined forces in a determinative attempt to break the back of America's electronic underground. It was a fascinating effort, with very mixed results. the hacker crackdown had another unprecedented effect. It spurred the creation, within the computer community, of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a new and very odd interest group, fiercely dedicated to the establishment and preservation of electronic civil liberties. The crackdown, remarkable in itself, has created a melee of debate over electronic crime, punishment, freedom of the press, and issues of search and seizure. Politics has entered cyberspace. Where people go, politics follow. This is the story of the people of cyberspace. Well, I think that's enough for today. I want to close with a couple of interesting anecdotes that may illustrate why I'm reading this book to you aloud. I had lunch earlier with a fellow named Tom Jennings. I had lunch with him a couple of weeks ago. He lives here in Los Angeles. Tom is notable for founding something called FidoNet. FidoNet was a really early predecessor to Usenet, or maybe contemporaneous offshoot of Usenet. It was a message board system that linked bulletin board systems all around the world using dial-up modems. Tom told me an amazing story about the early days of FidoNet. In the early days of FidoNet, there were lots of arguments, as there are today online, and sometimes those arguments became uncivil, as they do today online. And one of the things that sometimes happened in those uncivil discussions is that people would say a truly remarkable thing to one another. They would say, "How dare you speak to me this way in my own home? While you're here in my living room, you will keep a civil tongue in your head." This is, in fact, a remarkable thing for someone to say about a conversation taking place in cyberspace. But as far as these people were concerned, the conversation wasn't taking place in cyberspace. It was right there in their living room. Because this was before the term cyberspace had come into the popular imagination, and it was before we understood that the conversation wasn't taking place in your living room or mine, but all over the world. I emailed William Gibson about this, and he emailed back. He said, "You mean people then thought that Goetze was being spread right there in their living room?" I'm sure the pun was intentional. So I'll close finally by mentioning something I neglected in my intro, which is that last week, my story, When Sysadmins Ruled the Earth, a story about the last days of cyberspace, won the Locus Award. This is the third consecutive year in which I've won this award. I think of it as the most prestigious award in science fiction. It's certainly the one with the largest pool of voters. It's voted on by you, the readers, and many of you heard that story right here on this podcast as I was writing it. The story has gone on to be published first in Bane's Universe, a brave and interesting online magazine, and second in my collection Overclocked, and many of you, I'm sure, were kind enough to vote for it for Best Novelette of the Year, and for that I thank you very much. I'll be back next week with the next installment of The Hacker Crackdown. Until then, have a lovely week.